I'm Brian Karam, and I've spent decades covering politics. Now I'm taking you behind the scenes, one interview at a time.
Join us as each week Brian confronts the issues that matter, posing the questions you wish you could ask. No filter, no agenda, just the truth.
We're not here for sound bites. We're here for substance. Join me, Brian Karam, every week as we cut through the noise and get straight to it. This is Just Ask the Question, where curiosity will lead us to the facts.
Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform. And remember, when you want answers, all you have to do is just ask the question.
Welcome to the Start Me Up podcast, part of MSW Media and the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. I'm your host, Kimberly Johnson in D.C. Today, my returning guest is David Pepper. He's a lawyer, a writer, a political activist, former elected official, and adjunct professor. He served as the chairman of the Ohio Democratic Party. He's the author of Laboratories of Autocracy and Saving Democracy. He and I have a lot to discuss, but before we get into it, the Start Me Up podcast is independent, listener-funded, and woman-run. Visit patreon.com/startmeup to see the variety of tiers offered, including the option to get a bonus What's Up episode just for patrons every Tuesday. It's kind of like my online journal, where I get a little more personal and I talk about whatever's on my mind. There's also an ad-free tier with a much shorter intro. Just visit patreon.com/startmeup. Now please enjoy my conversation with David Pepper. Welcome back to the show, David.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Well, we are meeting once again under unfortunate times.
Oh my gosh.
This is pretty fucking bad.
I mean, between the East Wing and shutdowns and what's he want, $230 million paid to him and who knows what, and all the redistricting nonsense. Yeah, it's a crazy time.
Yeah. So, I mean, pretty much everything you just said, except for the $230 million I have on my notes. But First, I do want to talk about the No Kings March because they're saying that it's like Indivisible is saying it's between like it's over 7 million around. I've heard 8.7. I don't know, somewhere around 8 million. So that's pretty big. It's not the I can't remember what the percentage is that we need in order to reach whatever threshold that there will absolutely be change or whatever the experts say about how many people show up. But we saw a huge increase from the last march. And people are really upset. And I want to throw in here that Portland has really stepped up their game with how we fight these fascists with the frog and all the silly characters. There was some quote that I'm just going to basically do the quote. It's not verbatim, but it was the John Lennon quote that he says, like, they know what to do with you when you're violent, but when you're silly and you're fun, they don't know what to do. So I think, and then I also saw, there's a woman I watch on YouTube, Park Rose Permaculture. Her name is Angela. And she had brought in a video that a man had suggested that in order for Project 2025 to succeed, it hinges on us being violent. And we're not doing that. So I just wanted to ask you, like, what's your takeaways from this march? And what do you think, what kind of impact do you think it had on, you know, on whether it's legislators and then also the, you know, fascists?
Yeah, well, I it's two things. One, I couldn't agree more with what you just said. I read a book and it's kind of scary to me that I even was reading this book. And you may have heard of it. It's called From Dictatorship to Democracy by someone named Gene Sharp. A friend recommended it. And again, like the idea that I'm reading it because I'm trying to figure out how we don't become a dictatorship is scary. I'm not reading it as an academic thing, but he made the point, and what you just said reminds me of it. He said the way that he studied ways that countries that were dictatorships got out of it and got to democracy, and there's some very clear patterns. But his big push, one of them was, if you get into violence, they have massive advantage. They will always win a game of violence. That they're a dictatorship. They have force. That's a losing strategy. It just you are going against where they are strongest. So I agree on the Portland model. My aunt lives out in Portland at a Substack live with her the other day. There were a bunch of people in those costumes. There were four women playing bridge right outside that detention facility. I
Wow.
interviewed them, and the woman said to me, "Well, we want to show that it certainly cannot be called a war-ravaged city if four," and they said it this way, I would have, "if four old ladies can play bridge." Like, it's just, so I really, and so at the one I went to in Cincinnati, it was the same thing. I did selfies with a lot of the people in costume. And I just think it's a really good lesson. And it comes right out of that book. I mean, this guy studied this stuff and he said, once you get into violence, like, you are going to lose. They will put it down, and that's where they have you sort of outgunned, pardon the pun. But when you are creative and you have a plan that doesn't involve that, that's when you can win. The other thing I'd say, though, and again, I think, and I have a whole chapter in this new book I wrote about the importance of protests and them getting ever larger. But I gave a speech at the Cincinnati one, and I do think one of the most important things we can do, again, this is not to minimize the importance of the protests, but I said this to the crowd, what do we do but in between this and the next protest? What does every that millions of people, that is the force that can save our country. So in between these protests, what are each of us going to do? Is it engaging with disengaged voters? Is it making sure we're running in places that we don't often run? Is it getting the vote out to stop book banners in 2 weeks in school board races? Like, the power here is not just the protest, it's the people, and it's what they could each be doing in between the protests. And the other thing I said to the group is, I think you and I maybe talked to this before. I am so tired of us being the ones surprised by what all they what Trump does. Like, we're always surprised. We're always shocked. You know, they're going after their political enemies. Well, no shit. Pardon my French. They told us they were going to do that. Let's stop being surprised. They wrote it down what they're going to do. History tells us what they're going to do. This is not a secret. If we're surprised, it's because we're not paying attention. Our attitude should be, let's surprise them.
Yes,
Let's
definitely.
shock them. And what I love about these protests is, and you can tell the week before the protests, they are the ones scared. Oh my gosh, it's terrorists. It's this. And now they're saying it's a bunch of old people. They don't even know what to say about it. And you know what tells me? They're actually kind of surprised. They're like, my God, it's millions. And so let's surprise them with big protests, and then let's surprise them by all the activity that we do that supports democracy between the protests, like crushing them in Virginia next in 2 weeks. So our attitude has to be, what is our approach being, you know, those Portland people in costumes, it's kind of surprising them. They want us to be violent. They
Yes,
tell people to be
exactly.
violent. We're not violent. We're dressing up as dinosaurs and sharks. Good. Let's catch them off guard. So I actually like, I think that should be our mindset. And what I like about what's happening right now, amid all the terrible things, is I think they're a little off guard by the size of the protests, the creativity of them, the fact that they can't call a bunch of people dressed up as sharks and, you know, the birds or whatever, terrorists. It just doesn't make sense to people if they say that. So that has to be our continued mindset going forward.
Well, and we got the news that, there the only violence at any of these protests was done by MAGA, and there were
Yes.
no arrests or anything like that. Now, okay, here's my fear. I think that here's a legitimate fear that many of us have, is if there is no legitimate violence, that it will be made up by them, that they're going to throw someone in. But and before you comment on that, we had that sh the alleged shooter with the Charlie Kirk. They
Yeah.
initially tried to turn him into a dem a liberal, a progressive, whatever, because supposedly I think he had a trans was in a relationship with a trans person. They've just dropped that now. I mean, this whole thing with Charlie Kirk shooting is very strange to me. Everything about it is weird, and I'm not even going conspiratorial. I'm just looking at
Right.
how it's all played out, and it's just weird. But beyond that, they tried to make this alleged shooter into a Democrat, and they couldn't. And then now we just don't hear anything.
Yeah.
And so my question about like tying these two things together, how fearful are you that they're going to, go into crowds, whether it's a peaceful process, and like make it look like the liberals and the progressives are the ones doing violence. How afraid of you are.
Let me just put it this way. This, because I was speaking one of these, and so, you know, I have young kids. It's the first time I've thought about, and maybe I'm not careful of it. It's the first time I thought I'm worried. I'm not, I wouldn't say I was worried in a way that I wasn't going to go, but I thought we should all be thinking about our security. And the reason I thought that was because for the entire week, they were all so consistent in what they were saying. These are dangerous people. It's terrorists. It's communists. And I thought one of two things. And by the way, I don't think they, I think they were, now in hindsight, I think they were just scared. But I thought of one of two things. They are trying to trigger their people to do something by repeatedly turning this into something it wasn't. Or like someone may be thinking, well, let's make these into what we are saying they are. And I do worry that again, it, I'm glad it was very safe, except for a few people on the right disrupting. But it would be naive to not look around the world and see that, this is, that's a Putin tactic, false flag type things. And I do think it's another reason that we need to be the ones vigilant against violence. If something starts to happen that seems weird, don't participate, because I do think one way they would clamp down on what have been wonderful First Amendment, you know, to the extreme rallies, what's happening in Portland, they would want to have some threshold crossed that they could justify stopping them. And we can never fall for that. And I did worry as I watched them talk for a whole week. I mean, Mike Johnson, all these, they were all saying the same thing. And it was so consistent. And it had such a sort of tone of like what I felt was almost attempts to trigger people to do something they shouldn't do. I'm just glad nothing transpired. Too bad. They were bad incidents, but I did worry, and I'm glad that didn't happen. But yes, I do think it's something that we have to keep in the back of our mind, because it isn't some made up tactic. I mean, this is how other ill intentioned leaders of other countries have created crises that then they crack down on, is that type of thing. We
They
have to be
create the
thinking about that.
problem. Yeah, and then
Yeah, we
they
have
sell
to,
themselves
we
as the
have to be
solution.
thinking about that. And I do, and I, you know, I can't speak the Charlie Kirk thing, but I do think that it is odd. I mean, when all of a sudden all the information disappears, and this is also why, and I wrote about this when it was happening, it of course gets even worse when you throw in the layer that they've gotten rid of. And they've gotten rid of your standard FBI people, and they put Cash Patel, they fire people. Because it used to be, if the FBI said this happened, most Americans say, well, that must have been what had happened. But once they're politicizing Cash Patel himself, once they're getting rid of the longtime Utah FBI leaders and then replacing them, then all of a sudden the trust level we have that law enforcement is telling us what's really happened, like, the trust goes down. And so it does allow for, you know, it erodes trust, but also could allow for bad actors to do things. And all of a sudden, we don't know which way is up. So if they don't want people to think suspicious things about horrible acts, they shouldn't politicize the investigation process, which they have done by messing with the FBI in the way they have.
So, what do you think this? I'm going to ask you about the shutdown too, the same kind of question, but how do you think Republican legislators are feeling after seeing that? I mean, they're clearly going to be worried, but I mean, do you think that this is enough to push them into, I don't know, working with Democrats?
This is why I love, I think for the most part, they think, oh, it's a bunch of liberals in cities. And that's why I give huge credit to the people who are in Ironton, Ohio, in a very rural area, or smaller towns, or Jackson County. A friend of mine was there. The reason it's so important that these are done not just in the big cities is because this is true of testifying at a state house too. The more you bring the heat from where they live, so they can't in their mind dismiss it as, oh, that's the blue part of our country, the better. My guess is they aren't. There are two things that will take this and worry them more. One, it's that they actually have opponents, and they often don't. And two, when they start, again, surprise them. when they see losses where they're like, oh my God, I never thought that person could lose. And my hope is, hope, you know, I don't know what will happen. My hope is in 2 weeks, Virginia is a place where, like some of the special elections in the last 6 months, it had been surprising in how much a pretty red district was able to flip. My hope is that the combination of size of crowds, the fact that they're not only in cities, the fact that people are running against people in places where often they're used to not even having competition, and then actual losses because costs are too high or people are turned off by X, Y, or Z, or soybean farms are drying up, that losses in places aren't expected. I think that's when you start to have them think, you know, the guy running for senator in Ohio, for example, John Houston against Sherrod Brown, that's when you hope they think, well, I can't sustain this position right now because people are losing in elections they shouldn't be losing in because they're saying the same thing. So I think once it translates to elections is when their self-interest really gets triggered. And maybe they start changing behavior. But in a lot of parts of the country, that also means that we have to, on our side, be recruiting to run in places that often we don't run. And that's the only way they'll begin to sort of fear their own futures. And this is about, unless they fear repercussions in their own career for how they're behaving, they won't change their behavior. And that's why you have to run against them. That's why maybe legal repercussions if they ever face accountability for breaking the law. But the lesson is, like, these people don't mind being told they violate the Constitution. They just don't
They
care
don't
because, you
care.
know, what they would care about, though, is if they thought, wait a second, I may lose my own office. That's something they almost never have felt because we're in a gerrymandered world and we have to organize what we do in a way that they finally feel some accountability in their own life, in their own career, because they may lose or they're found liable for breaking the law or whatever.
You posted a video, I don't know, maybe it was with your relative, I don't know, but you were talking about how gerrymandering corrupts and undermines the common good. So I just wanted you to speak to that a little bit because obviously we see what's happening with Gavin Newsom and the Republicans trying to get, more and more R's on the ticket, and now they're doing it in California. What are your thoughts on that overall? And then, talk about the gerrymandering and why it corrupts.
Yeah, so this is a woman who you should interview her sometime. She started about, she's not a relative, but I knew her from politics here. She lives in a very rural part of Ohio. It's called Jackson County. And about 3 months ago, she started doing videos from her porch. And she calls it Mama's Front Porch. And she is just dropping truth bombs on everything from a rural Ohio perspective. And it is gold, okay? She went from almost nothing on Facebook to 60,000 followers. She is getting huge video watches, hundreds of thousands or millions of views. And she's cutting through with very common sense. And so that's why I interviewed her. And I'm going to be in that county in a few weeks, so I hope to sit down in person. She's interviewing Amy McGrath next week in Kentucky because Kentucky's not too far
I'm
from where
totally
she
going to
is.
interview
Oh, you're going to see one
her.
coming. She is absolutely brilliant. But people won't see that at first. They, oh, she's got a Southern Ohio accent. But she is explaining things about politics and the law and policy in a very common sense way that often we struggle to do. And you can see in the response, it's one of my most viewed Substacks ever, just the conversation. So I talked to her again the other day because we had such a good time talking. She and I, we just were talking about schools and about how much public schools are being undermined by these vouchers, especially in rural Ohio. And she just basically said, well, yeah, and this is what I've written about in my books, that once you have no accountability back to the citizens, the only place you have accountability is with big donors. And that's true of Ohio, that's true of Washington. And so basically, gerrymandering is a fast track to corruption, where basically every, and this is my broader point too, state houses like Ohio, like Texas, so badly gerrymandered that essentially the people are checked out of the equation, essentially aren't public service, and we should stop thinking they are. It is the harnessing of public power for private gain and private interests, and some of the private gain gets paid back to the politicians through contributions. It's one massive grift, and the gerrymandering is the key because it means the p because what happens when you privatize the public good through these state houses is public outcomes fall. Healthcare gets worse, schools get worse, it all gets worse. Gerrymandering is the key because the only way you can get away with delivering such terrible public outcomes everywhere is if you create a system where the public can't stop it. And that's what she and I were saying, which is that gerrymandering is sort of writ large, just massive corruption of the entire public purpose of these institutions. And they basically become, private serving institutions, the abuse of public power to serve private ends. And gerrymandering is, again, at the heart, it's the key mechanism that allows it to continue. Because, of course, if you were delivering the god-awful results we're seeing in fair districts, you'd all lose your next election. So, yeah, that's the system. And that's why in highly gerrymandered states, they're destroying public schools, even though the public doesn't like it. They pass laws like, Dobbs or crazy abortion bans, even though 40% of the state or less supports that. They pass gun laws that are completely opposite of what the people want. It's all because private interests are getting what they want and the public can't do anything about it. And that's essentially what she was talking about. In a place like hers, where there's often no competition at all, it's even more clear that that's what they're living through.
How are you? I mean, I don't know anything about this, but how, like, what's happening now in regards to the different places in America where normally there's not a challenger, but there is not, like, are we get how much better are we getting at that?
We are doing better, and this is the good news. So when I first started writing about this, when you and I probably first did a few of these podcasts, I think people thought, who is this idiot from Ohio who thinks we should run in more places? Like, what's he talking about? That's a terrible idea. What a waste. Well, talk to Anderson Clayton, the North Carolina chair, about it. Because she ran, North Carolina was a perfect example. In 22, they left dozens of seats uncontested. She's a young chair, brand new. When she became chair, she said, well, I'm from rural North Carolina. I don't want to have 20 or 30 Republicans who don't even have a challenger explaining to the people what they're doing to ruin our state. So she recruited in all but two districts. And who had a great year in 24, even with Trump on the ballot? North Carolina. Not only did they win the statewide races, but they won a Supreme Court race by 700 votes. I guarantee you, if they had not had dozens of Democrats running in tough districts, knocking on doors of Democrats to get them to vote, they would not have won that race. Similar story in Arizona 2 years before, by the way. People ran in some tough districts. The Attorney General, Chris Masey of Arizona, won by 300 votes. So when you're running everywhere, you're on message. You're bringing accountability to extremists. You're lifting turnout. And so Anderson Clayton was a great model. And this, in 2 weeks, we're going to see it again. In Virginia, there is a candidate in every single district, a
Oh,
Democrat.
good.
It's the Republicans that have left 20 or 25 districts without a op
Oh, that's
opposition.
interesting.
It's the Democrats who are running everywhere. There's a website that is supporting like 27 candidates running in the hardest districts. It's raised, six figures for those candidates. And I think my hope is, and so if you're Abigail Spanberger, you know that in some of the most rural red parts of Virginia, you of course are campaigning there, but you have a Democratic state rep candidate knocking on doors, talking to Democratic voters who otherwise maybe didn't have anything to focus on. And my hope is that this all every single district strategy in Virginia, that we see it pay off in a big way, and that we see that not only Spanberger wins, but we build a trifecta. We pick up state house seats. The other thing about running in these rural districts is that the Republican caucus of the Virginia, I think it's called the House of Delegates, they can't only spend now in a few districts when they know that every single one of their people is being challenged. So they have to divvy up the money more. So my hope is that that just like North Carolina, last year, Virginia becomes an example that we all say from now on, sure, it's an uphill battle to run in these tough districts, but it's a lot better than not running because there are a lot of benefits that come from it when it comes to messaging, turnout, accountability, pushing them to spend their money in different ways. And so we have some momentum that we got some new leaders, and Ken Martin is helping with this too. We've got some new leaders that are seeing that the old strategy of leaving half of America uncontested it's been a disaster. And that running in more places over time is a much better strategy than simply leaving, half of Louisiana or half of Tennessee with a bunch of Republicans who've in their life, like Mike Johnson, have never really faced a real opponent. It's making them much more extreme when that's the only thing they've ever experienced.
Wow. So, okay, now we've got this whole government shutdown thing. And, what's interesting about this is Marjorie Taylor Greene is standing up to her own party. She's very upset about the Epstein files. She specifically said that Republican men are weak. And I can't remember the follow-up, but it was something like, and they're afraid of strong Republican women. Now, I see a lot of Democrats out there. I'm not going to defend her, and you don't have to. You don't have to become her best friend, but you can absolutely delight in the fact that she is standing up against her own party. That doesn't make her a Democrat. That doesn't even necessarily make her an ally, but it does make her. What she's doing is she's helping, whether she wants to or not, she's helping the Democrats. And she's, showing, and it's the whole Epstein thing, that's such a big deal. So they're not, and pardon me, I don't remember that woman's name who was elected and Mike Johnson has refused to seat her. But, this is pretty much about the Epstein files. I'm sure there are other things happening that, they're doing this, but I think the Epstein files, and correct me if you think I'm wrong about that, but that is like the big major thing. And so my whole point of this is if it truly is about the Epstein files and keeping them sealed, they can't. I mean, are
I
they going to
mean,
go ahead?
I think a lot of it is. I think there's very little incentive for most of them. But no, I completely agree with you. That when someone on their side is making our arguments, and again, if let's say Spangenberger wins Virginia by 10,
Oh my God, I hope
and
so.
that's a state that's going to be feeling the cost of the shutdown more than others. And if that results the way I think it could. And Marjorie Taylor Greene's been saying these things. They're going to be the ones who are going to have sort of a come to Jesus. Like, whoa, maybe she's the one who's figured it out, and we're the idiots who are defending like sky high health costs and a shutdown. Like, they're literally basically the position of the current Senate. I keep bringing him up because we want to beat him. Senator Houston of Ohio. His position is basically, yes, we're going to have a shutdown so I don't have to relieve health costs. I mean, it's a horrible, horrible political position. And I think if it continues and if the next election is sort of a referendum partly on this, I think the others will start to think, just like, I can't remember. Well, who's the, I'm looking over the river in Kentucky where he's his congressman, the Cong Tom Massey, Thomas Massey. Same thing. He's taking a principled stand on Epstein. And I think they are going to, even though they're, I'm sure, getting bullied in their own party, at some point, the others, because people in the end are self-interested, if they look around and think, wait a second, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massey seem to be doing better. And our side, the MAGA side in that Virginia race, just got clobbered. I think it does start to make them think, maybe we should vote to open up the Epstein files. But yeah, I think so much of the unwillingness to, I think almost all the unwillingness to meet in Washington right now is this, the abject fear, or maybe not even fear, the knowledge of what's in the Epstein files. They clearly, some know, and they do not want to have a session where they have to begin that process. And so, no, I think they're scared of that. And I'm trying to find it while we're talking. There was a poll was done by a Bowling Green not long ago, and I'll look it up over the course of a conversation. They asked about many things, but they did ask about the Epstein file in it, and it shows you just how toxic it is. There are very few things in this poll that have much crossover. This thing is like absolutely. Republicans, Democrats, Independents are all on the same page about that this is a cover-up. I mean, it's very, very devastating. And I think, a lot of can like here's an example. I've been trying to be helpful to a woman running for governor here against Vivek Ramaswamy. Ramaswamy, when he was running for president, literally talked about Epstein all the time. He even took credit. I was the first and most vocal proponent of releasing the Epstein files. Well, his opponent in Ohio, her name is Amy Acton, called for him 2 months ago to make good on that and join her in calling for them now. It's been like 90 days. He won't say a word about it.
He won't do it. Yeah.
And when and all these people are being put in this position that now that Trump's president, they can't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
They look like hypocrites. But now they're part of the group that will that are covering up for these crimes and any connections. And I'll find in a second, the polling on that behavior in Ohio is so underwater for them. So it's just an example where sticking to the script. The other place where this is going to happen is they don't want to upset Trump.
Right.
So they won't acknowledge that costs are up.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to mention inflation. Why? Because if they did, Trump would call them up and said, wait, costs aren't up and I'm a great president. And if you say they're up, you're undermining me. So I think a whole lot of Republicans are right now in a corner where the things that would be the best things for them to say politically, like release the Epstein files and we're going to lower costs, they can't say. And I think in the next year, that's going to be a real problem for them. And the smart ones will figure it out and maybe start pulling away from the president a little bit. But most of them, I think, are going to just keep standing on these very, very sort of thin ice political ground.
Did you see the tweet? It was a couple of, I don't know, it was like last week or something. Eric Swalwell did this whole thread, and he said there was going to be 100 of Republican defectors. But we haven't seen anything like that. Do you know anything about that?
So I'm good friends with my congressman, and I think he says that he thinks they also – this is my congressman's name is Greg Landsman,
mm-hmm.
and he's someone who's pretty savvy about building relationships across party lines. And I did a Substack Live with him the other day, and he said something similar that I think there is a groundswell that's not happy with leadership that is probably worried about this health conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But the deadline that he suggested has passed. We'll see if they figure it out. But
right.
I think you do have a situation where I think the ones who kind of pay attention know that Trump, you know, Mike Johnson won't do anything that Trump doesn't want him to do. And Mike Johnson, by doing so, is putting a number of the rank and file Republicans in a very bad position. But I hate to say it, like despite what, and I'm a fan and friend of Swalwell's too. The thing that I have never seen is any of them get enough of a backbone to do the right thing or to do the smart thing.
Right.
They just can't separate. And that's why it has been striking to see Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, it's like, wow, she really is going all in. And Thomas Massie is taking no prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what he is seeing is actually there is a audience that appreciates even the Republican Party someone standing up to this stuff. And so I think my guess is Massie is getting a lot of grief, but my guess is he's also getting a lot of people saying, thank you, you're speaking up on things like Epstein, good for you. But the rest of them, I think, are so afraid of Trump punishing them
mm-hmm.
that they're unwilling to do it. We'll see if that changes. But I'm always pretty skeptical when we start relying on them to find a backbone.
They generally
do not do that.
Well, we've got the Epstein file situation. We've got the government shutdown. And I feel like, I don't know, I with the Republican voters, now add to it the fact that he's demolished the East Wing illegally, because normally if you're going to do anything to a historical building, you have to have congressional approval. And there are certain things that you can't do. To a historic building. There's rules and stuff that they clearly just ignored those rules. So you've got these three things. Now, I know that's not enough to just collapse the MAGA movement, but, you know, there has ever with this whole Epstein thing, it's created some kind of a riff. There is some division within MAGA. It's not completely destroyed. But I mean, you know, what's your take on the fact that all these things are happening? You know, the Republicans understand, even though there's going to be a group of MAGA who are going to blame the shutdown on Democrats because they've been told that by whatever liar. But most of these people know it's the Republicans that are doing it. The Republicans aren't releasing the Epstein files as they promised. And the Republican president is demolishing the White House. And do you I know it's still not enough to wake everyone up, but do you think this is that these three things in particular are going to have a really negative effect in the long run with the Republican voters?
I think the one that does is that I just found the polling I talked about. They asked Ohio voters, Some say the Epstein case involves a cover-up by the powerful elites. Do you think it's a cover-up? 88% yes,
Wow.
12% no. Okay. I'm looking at the 83% of Republicans said it, 95% of Democrats,
Wow.
88% of independents. And then when you go down to how is Trump handling it? 24% on the positive, 76% negative.
Wow.
That included underwater 45-55 with Republicans, underwater 14-86 with independents.
Wow.
So that the, of the issues that are not your everyday issues, I hate to say it, as much as it sickens me, I took my kids on a White House tour a year and a half ago. I would have never known that maybe what I was seeing, and I haven't paid attention to everything they're tearing down, maybe the last time they'll ever see it. I don't think some of the stuff we focus on breaks through. The Epstein one clearly is bad for them, but I think the one that really does open it up is as the economy costs, tariffs, health costs. That's the opening, I think, that we need to see and grab by being savvy about talking about it. You know, I told a story and I wrote about it on Substacks and I tweeted it the other day. I was at a wedding in Kentucky, okay, overlooking the river, beautiful part of Kentucky, and I ran into a logger who happened to be a relative of the groom, and he told me, "I'm from Appalachia, Kentucky. We are getting," he goes, "it's logging country. That's all we all do." He said, "We are all getting destroyed. We have no business. We have no market. It's just piling up." And then he said, "The bourbon industry in Kentucky is dying. Dying. Canadians are not buying bourbon ever again. And once we lose these markets, they are not coming back." So this is just an example of the pain that Trump is inflicting on soybean farmers, loggers, you name it. I tweeted this out, okay? I said, "This was really interesting to hear that." And the first response was, "Well, you know, screw that guy, you know, for FAFO. I hope he goes bankrupt," all this stuff. And I actually clarified, just so everyone knows, this guy was a total Democrat. He was a proud Democrat. But then I said, "But you know what? It doesn't even matter. Because if we want to win in the future, well, yeah, he's connecting what Trump's doing to the pain he's feeling. He sees it and he's feeling the pain. And when we see someone with higher health costs, or that, or what this guy's dealing with, or entire industry's collapsing, that is not the time to say, I'm glad it's happening, you're going bankrupt. It's the time to say, we worried about this, we were warning about this, but you know what? We can fix it." And this is how Andy Beshear's governor of Kentucky, because that's how he would respond. So when I think the biggest, in addition to Epstein and some of these things, I think the sad opportunity will come when millions of people see their ACA premiums skyrocket. They see their own businesses, their counties drying up. And if we are savvy enough not to celebrate it, of course, connect what they're feeling to the policies that are screwing them over. Make sure they see that without rubbing their face. And then say, "Guys, there's a better way. And we're going to lead to that way." Because I think those everyday, if we tumble into recession, the costs to continue to go up. The Republican candidates like Vivek cannot talk about these things for fear of pissing off Donald Trump. If all that happens, all those issues I think add up to giving us a really big opportunity in 26. If we're smart enough to, you're not, you know, maybe 9 and 10 voters will still vote how they would have, or 8 and 10. But if you can grab 2 or 3 out of 10, and we have a high turnout, and they don't show up because they're seeing this economic depression inflicted upon them by their own leadership, that's how you sweep elections in Ohio, not just Virginia, but Ohio. But we've got to be smart enough to take that. The raw pain people are feeling, being empathetic enough to then channel into enough voters that switch or at least see that we have a better way. And that's how you all of a sudden turn things around next year, in addition to the sort of high profile stuff like Epstein.
Okay, so here's the scary question I have for you. We keep hearing, whether it's Stephen Miller or Donald Trump or even just, other Republicans talking about that they want to enact the Insurrection Act in order to stop elections. So, yeah, this is a people are afraid about this. What are your thoughts?
I worry when they talk about it. Donald Trump has wanted to do the Insurrection Act for years. Pete Hegseth is there because I don't think he would say no. I do think this is a moment where those generals who clearly sat in silence, not impressed by Trump or Hegseth, I think we would need to just hope that they do the right thing and do not go along with orders that I think are, not legal. And I don't like waiting around for the court system to save us because this Supreme Court has not shown an inclination to do that. But my hope is in that case, the illegality of truly getting troops into these states and cities would be called out very clearly. I think if that weren't to happen, I think the protests and everything else we're doing would have to be far bigger. I mean, I do think that we just would have to keep ramping up even more. I just, you don't really have a choice. I mean, at the end of the day, what we do, I talk about elections a lot, and winning elections in the end is a key way out. But if they're taking on things that make elections, truly rigged even more than they are, or threatening other stuff, like the biggest power we have is to show up in masses that they've never seen. And you want every politician to see those crowds. You want every judge to see those crowds. You want everybody to see. We've seen this in other countries. Like certain things happen, and the scenes in a big foreign city are enormous. Like I think if they start going there, we have to be that big in what we. The other day was big, but it's got to be even
Oh, it's
more
bigger,
shockingly
right?
big than that. Like in the end, the best lever we have. And by the way, the other lever is how we spend our money. And at
That's
key
where we have our
moments,
power.
and at key moments, Disney felt the squeeze. The squeeze is an understatement of what they felt with Kimmel. And if we are all saying with our money, we are gonna, not support any entities that are suppressing democracy. We're on this, the way that Tesla has gone through just a meltdown. I think large crowds energizing around elections, how we spend or don't spend our money. I mean, there are certain levers that we can pull that we can pull ever bigger. And the more they do that, the more we're gonna have to do our side. I want the courts to save us on the ones like this that are so extreme. But I'm not sitting around watching MSNBC coverage of court hearings at that moment. We just have to be out en masse, like making massive statements about with millions and millions of people.
Yeah, and I like to remind people that this holiday season, we don't necessarily at this point want to stop the economy because we're all part of the economy and it will affect us. But instead of buying all of our presents at the big box stores, getting Amazon gift cards, I've been suggesting that, and I think a lot of people are going to do this, that we can still, if you've got money to spend on the people that you love, you can do it with local. You can do online, like the Etsy kind of stuff. There are, I was trying to think of like what could you do if you wanted to get somebody a gift certificate? Well, you could get them a gift certificate to a local, like if it's a woman, a local hair or nail salon. Things like that, because it's stuff that we always use, but it's not giving money over to Jeff Bezos. It's not giving money over to all of those big corporations. It's still and it could help the little guy out there who's really struggling instead of going, you might little pay a little bit more, but it just, it I remember there was this episode of Little House on the Prairie, and I've posted about this, but one year the two girls, Laura and Mary, got oranges and they were so excited, and it was because, I mean, I don't know, early 1900s, and it was in the middle of winter, obviously. So it wasn't like they had oranges all of the time. So it was a huge treat for them. And I feel like, we are living in this consumer world, capitalist consumer world, and we all like our big money gifts and our bling. And it's like back in the olden days, we were happy to get an orange, and it's like, I think we need, there are other things we could do, like donating our time. And I, that's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, because Indivisible right now, and I keep talking about Indivisible because I think it's such a great resource. It offers everybody tools on how to fight fascism, but not just through voting and elections. It's ways to help the vulnerable in your community. So, like one of the things that I read was just people going to, nursing homes and spending time. And even though that doesn't seem like, oh, I'm saving democracy by doing it, it's forming a sense of community. So there, what I wanted to ask you is, and you mentioned this earlier, like what can we do in between those marches? What can we do a year ahead of time, whether it's having to do with elections themselves or just ways to protect our communities? What do you recommend?
So this is a big part of what I said the other day, and it's half of my book, Saving Democracy, is about this topic. And Indivisible, you know this. They started literally as a manual of what to do. That's how they started, which I speak at a lot of their events. The way I would think about it, the way I describe it is everyone has a footprint of influence in this world. And we use almost none of it for democracy. We give a little time sometimes to volunteer in the last couple of weeks of a campaign. And every once in a while, people will give money to a candidate. But in the grand scheme of the country, almost no one does even that. But most of us, that's all we do. And once you realize that democracy itself is at stake and you make it your core mission to save it, the truth is there's so much more you could do from your footprint to save democracy. And I'll just give a few examples. The nursing home is a great, great one. But I'm going to give ones that may even feel more direct than just community building. One of the biggest tactics in undermining democracy is purging irregular voters. And basically, the other one is that voters themselves, many of them have decided that voting doesn't matter to them. So you have an entire world, about half the country, that largely doesn't participate. There is no reason in the world why all of us could not use our footprint to re-engage these voters through registration, engagement. And I don't mean that in just a general sense. Like, here's an example. Are you on, do you volunteer at a homeless shelter? When you're at the homeless shelter, are they registering people show up? Because if they're not, maybe as a volunteer, after one day you're there, you say, "Hey guys, you can register everyone who comes in this door." Like, who else is going to do it? You're the best positioned. You're the one helping them. Food bank. Do you give money to a food bank? Well, is the food bank engaging the people it serves, who it helps, to also be registered? Or health clinics. If every single mayor in America, and they're mostly Democrats, every single one is sitting in power in the very place where the Republicans and state houses are trying to stop voting and purge voters. So there is no reason why every mayor in America is not using every rec center, every library, every public housing unit as a place where people are reminded and given a path to register to vote. If you know a mayor of a city, ask them if they're doing that. If they're not, tell them you should be, because this is where the other side, whenever they're in power, they use their power to crush democracy. When we're in power, we should be thinking through creatively all the ways we can use it to lift democracy. Or another example is, the lowest hanging fruit in democratic politics is the precinct level organizing we could all be doing every single month of every single year. And if you're in a neighborhood that you don't really feel like anyone's doing that, well, take ownership of your community and decide, I'll organize it. I'll find all the Democrats in the neighborhood. When someone new moves in the neighborhood, I'll welcome them and say, "Hey, welcome. We vote in this community. You should vote too. Here's your registration form." If there's an apartment building in your neighborhood, find some, and often these are the places that are overlooked by campaigns entirely or until very late. Find some of that apartment building and recruit them to be the captain of that apartment building when it comes to democracy. And so they welcome new apartment building residents. "Hey, we're part of the pro-democracy team of this place. Welcome. Here's how you register here. We got a meeting every month where we talk about what's going on." Like, there is so much we could all be doing. And I worry that for the most part, while the other side's scale and their attack on democracy is enormous, we are allowing most of what we could be doing to simply not happen because we have never in our own mind thought through almost everything we do every day as volunteers, as workers, as givers of money at our workplace. All of that footprint could be used to lift democracy. And for the most part, we simply don't do it. So their scale, they do it. The Koch brothers spent money and corporate dollars, all of it, to crush democracy. We need to use all that we have to lift it. And if we do, there are more of us than them. We could scale up. And so that's what I said to this crowd, the No Kings, like, challenge yourself to think through, what do you do in life? What do you do every day? What are your networks? And what of those nodes could be used to lift democracy? If we all do that, that's when it really starts to turn around.
All right, so my last question to you is, what are you hopeful about right now?
I am hopeful, just like we've won almost every special election, I am hopeful that despite all the chaos and the reason to be down, and there are many reasons, that we see in 2 weeks in Virginia the consequences of what happens when we have a good candidate against a MAGA candidate, and when we run everywhere with passion and we support those candidates. And my hope is that that is the beginning of the midterm where we save democracy. And if people see that it worked in Virginia, if people see that running everywhere paid off, we took on extremists, we win a trifecta in Virginia decisively, my hope is that people see that and say, okay, well, let's do it in many more states next year. And 26 is the year where, again, I get real impatient when everyone just speculates on who's going to run for president in 28. There are a lot of
Yeah.
good people thinking about it. 28's too late to save democracy, folks.
Right.
The 26th midterm is when we save it. And that starts in 2 weeks
Yeah.
with Virginia and New Jersey.
Oh, and I'm so hopeful.
Yeah, so we do that, and then they get scared, and we just build of give let's give Virginia credit, the party, grassroots activists, the candidates. They set it up for success. They create a model of running everywhere. And if they can do it in this environment, then we just roll into the early 26 and do the same thing in far more places. Don't go back to the business as usual of our mistakes. Learn from a state that seems to be doing it well. And all states around the country, Democrats, pro-democracy folks, whatever party, learn from it and build. And all of a sudden, we have, I think, a potentially very, very good year. If you're thinking about running, my free advice, there's never a better time to run for office than in the midterm, the second midterm of an unpopular president. So if you're thinking, I talked to a guy yesterday in Northwest Ohio, very rural, former Republican. He's thinking about running for state house. I was like, there's no better time.
Yeah.
And running is public, don't, you know, it may be a hard district. You may or may not win, but running in this moment of democracy, the run itself is public service.
Yeah.
You are lifting, you are getting turnout, you're on message, you're holding someone accountable. So if you've ever thought about running, 26 is about as good as year we're ever going to have, I think. So think, and when you watch what happens in Virginia, let that fuel you into running yourself if you've got the inclination.
Yes, because that Republican candidate is fucking batshit. So, I mean, if she wins, I
Yeah.
will be very
And you
surprised.
know, she's no different from Vivek
No,
Ramaswamy.
she's not.
She like that's who they're running. They are not running the old style that
Yeah.
was more moderate, like our current governor in Ohio. They are
Right.
running the far right, and we are if we ran good candidates like Spangberger against their candidates in a lot of states, I think we end up the winner. If we run everywhere and don't leave 30 or 40% of a state with no infrastructure at all, we do far better at all levels. So learn from Virginia. These matchups could be good, and running everywhere gives us a better shot. And then just like I said, keep rolling to 26.
All right, David, you got me all hopeful.
All
So,
right, good. That was my goal.
so before I let you go, please tell everyone where to find you.
So I'm pretty active on Substack. If you just look up David Pepper, or the name of my Substack is Pepperspectives. I'm on Twitter still, David Pepper. They seem to suppress a lot of what I put out. I'm on Blue Sky. That's mainly where I put my stuff out. I do a lot of posts now on Substack as well. So all those places you could find me. And if you like some of the deep dive stuff, I've written a bunch of books that you can find as well.
Yes, and I've included those in the Patreon description. I've got Laboratories of Autocracy and Saving Democracy, which I highly,
Awesome.
highly, highly, highly recommend everybody. If you're going to read one, read Saving Democracy because he gives you all these pointers and it's just so fantastic. So, David, thanks once again for sharing your wisdom. I love talking to you, and I know we're going to talk again.
Let's do it. Let's
All
go,
right.
Virginia, everybody. Take care.
Take care.
Good talking
Bye-bye.
to you. Okay, bye.
Hi. Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyal from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.